Welcome back, everyone, Zoom friends. Those of us here in the room, it's a very gray day in Victoria, very blustery and cold. But the hellebore are blooming in the gardens here. So, this title came to me doing a bit of research, seeing what other people were being, what other courses were being offered in different places, and this jumped out at me. It comes from a poem by the Sufi mystic Jalaluddin Rumi. And tomorrow I'll read you the whole poem, but today just a couple of verses. You must have shadow and light source, both. Listen and lay your head under the tree of awe. You must have shadow and light source, both. Listen and lay your head under the tree of awe. When from that tree feathers and wings sprout on your soul, be quiet, quieter than a dove. Don't open your mouth for even a coo. So awe. Krista Tippett, who is the host of the podcast On Being, recently interviewed a man named Dacher Keltner, a scientist. And when she was introducing him, I was quite moved by how she spoke about their long conversation over the years. And she described it as a shared conversation on the topic of curiosity and wonder. So this idea that we can be in friendship with each other over many, many years and encourage and invite and awaken that ongoing interest. What is it like to be human? What is it like to, you know, let go of the things you love or the things you love to do? So that idea of opening in conversation with each other, these topics of the mystery of being human. So in introducing him, she said, there are moments when we have a sense of wonder, an experience of mystery that transcends our understanding. These, it turns out, are as common in human life globally as they are measurably health-giving and immunity-boosting. They bring us together with others again and again. They bring our nervous system and heartbeat and breath into sync, and even into sync with other bodies around us. This science is a wildly accessible, minute-to-minute invitation to practice a common human experience that is literally life-giving and nourishing, and actively good for this world of pain and promise that we inhabit. So I was joking with a friend about how science always seems to be a little bit behind. Like, I think Indigenous peoples knew a little bit about mystery and wonder and awe. I think children know quite a bit about it. But science likes to measure things. And I guess that's not bad, because if it leads more people to get interested, I mean, even my father in his elder years, when he read an article about the benefits of science, benefits according to science of meditation, he got quite interested. But the next thing we know, science will tell us that breathing is good for us. Or it's actually good to smile occasionally. Or drinking water is actually good for your health. So this neuroscientist, Dr. Keltner, in his book, he talks about the eight wonders of awe, or I think maybe he calls it eight wonders of the world, or the eight new wonders. So I'll just speak about a couple of them today. But one of them is called moral beauty. Moral beauty. And he quotes from the American writer Toni Morrison, who speaks about allowing goodness its own speech. Allowing goodness its own speech. And in the moment when she was using that phrase, she was talking about how she saw this to be the purpose of her creative life and literature, as having this capacity to inspire goodness by the depiction and exploration of what it means to live an ethical life. So, this moral beauty, this apparently, we might have thought that wonder, awe, the top of the list would be nature. Niagara Falls, the Grand Canyon, you know, the marvels that we see in the natural world. But for people around the world in his study, he discovered that actually what most commonly led people to feel awe was an experience of other people's courage, kindness, strength, or overcoming. It's other people around us, everyday people, who bring us awe. It's kind of amazing, really, and kind of wonderful. So I'll just tell you a little story. I'll try not to go into too much detail, but... So I had the good fortune to meet an activist in his elder years. His name was Jim Bolan. And I read his memoir. It's no longer in print, but you can get it at the library in Vancouver. And in his memoir, he talked about his own journey. So to me, that's always such an amazing question. You know, what led you here? How did you come to this choice? And in his memoir, he talks about being a young man growing up in Brooklyn. His parents, his grandparents were, on both sides, were immigrants. And it was a very, you know, bustly life in the late 20s, early 30s. And he described watching his grandfather earn a few dollars by teaching people how to play chess in Washington Square Park in New York City. So times were tough, but his grandfather was industrious and took initiative and figured out a way to make some money. He was old enough to be drafted when the United States entered the Second World War. But after the war, he was part of a naval crew. He was sort of partway through his engineering degree, and they were in the waters off Alaska in the Aleutian Islands. So it's the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s, and they came to this amazing archipelago. If you've ever seen it on a map, it extends thousands of miles east towards Siberia. And it's this dot, it's almost like an arm outstretched. like the bones of an arm outstretched. It's so beautiful. And they came ashore on one of the islands, which had been a naval base during the war. And there they saw all the detritus, the bunkers, the, you know, shelters, all the cement, and this kind of the U.S. Army just leaving everything behind and abandoning the site. And it, you know, it touched him that this pristine environment should be so littered with war debris, debris from war. But they had an afternoon, and they met some of the Aleut people who lived nearby, and they watched the otters and saw the ducks, the droves of ducks. And then he had some time, and he wandered up into a little plateau above the shoreline. And he lay down in the grass. It was more like a stubby heather. And the scent of it, this sort of wild scent, was all around him. And he looked up at the sky. And this intuition came to him, arising out of this period of time following the destruction of the Second World War, seeing all this debris on the coastline. This intuition came to him. He was only in his 20s, that his whole life could be dedicated to care of the natural world. And he didn't know how that aspiration would play out. He didn't know where it would take him, but he let it plant a seed in him. And so he finished his tour of duty, he finished his degree as an engineer, got a job near Philadelphia, got married, had children, and he met some Quakers in Philadelphia who were protesting the nuclear bomb testing that was beginning to happen in the Bikini Islands, the atolls, and also in Nevada. And his job actually turned out to be somewhat tangentially related to the arms industry, so he couldn't do it. So he started to look for work in Canada. And he flew up to Vancouver. He got an interview at UBC, and he was offered a job in the forestry department. So his family joined him, and they settled in Kitsilano. And they looked around for like-minded people, as we do. And he found out there was a kind of offshoot of the Sierra Club in Vancouver. And he began meeting with members of this group. And this was late 60s now. And the Atomic Energy Commission had, for several years, in secret and then gradually more in the public eye, begun sinking a shaft into the earth on the island of Amchitka, in order to test their newest iteration of the nuclear or the hydrogen bomb. And so they formed a committee. They called it the Don't Make a Wave Committee, because in 69, the memories were still very fresh of the 9.3 earthquake in Alaska that had sent a tidal wave, a tsunami, down the coast and even over to Hawaii, and led to significant damage in Port Alberni, when even in that inland channel, there was a huge wave that came in and damaged many buildings. So the Don't Make a Wave Committee, that's what, you know, he was involved with. And they were raising money, you know, selling buttons, and they were having meetings, and it was the 60s, and one day one of their small group was leaving, and he said, as he was leaving, he said, "Peace." You can just imagine it, peace. You could just give it that intonation of the 60s. And someone else in the group said, "Yeah, let's make it a green peace." And that was 1970, and the there's someone in this audience who actually attended the benefit concert for Greenpeace in 1970. They invited Joni Mitchell to come. James Taylor came as her special guest. Somebody knew somebody, and she had put out her song, Big Yellow Taxi. And so she was kind of pressed. Well, let's see if you can follow up that wonderful song with supporting us in raising some funds. So they raised enough money to buy an old halibut seiner and sail it up into the waters off Amchitka. And they were savvy enough, because they had media people on their team, savvy enough to know how to make their story one that would gather the attention of the world. And it did. Even though they had to turn back because the Atomic Energy Commission kept delaying the test until it was impossible for them to stay any longer and they had to turn back. But nonetheless, they were tracking their whole story and telling their whole story on radio, on live broadcast, and getting interest and gathering interest. And it was really because of efforts of Greenpeace that I think, was the second to last of those deep shaft bomb tests that took place. And what happened is that Greenpeace caught the imagination of activists around the world and spawned hundreds of other organizations. I mean, they weren't the first, but their style, their sense of theater and drama, and their willingness to engage people's imagination had a huge effect. And now they're in almost, countries around the world, and they are charting quiet success after success. And I just looked up a couple. One of them is the company that makes Gore-Tex has committed and developed technology to make a similar substance without using PFCs, which are harmful to the environment. So, and they, they address habitat issues, but also toxic waste and multitude of other concerns. And they have staunchly remained member-funded by citizens. So this one, so interesting that Jim Bolin, this engineer from Philadelphia, ended up in Vancouver, met with these Sierra Club members, some of whom were Quakers, and together they had enough imagination to create a bit of theater, create a bit of interest, and actually taking a lot of risks, taking this boat out in the open sea up to the Aleutian Islands. So I have a lot of respect and admiration. And I'm sure, as we know, there always are politics, and even in groups who share common goals. But just, that moment of decision, that moment of recognition of one person's potential. And I'm sure you can think of individuals who've inspired you in a similar way, just by, their choice, their deliberate choice to swim against the stream. And that's what we're doing. I mean, you're still here. And the woman who left, she informed me that she was not going because she was on her way to the Shambhala Center. She was part of a rowing crew, and they were going rowing, but she'd be here tomorrow. I appreciated her telling me. So we're still here. We're swimming against the stream of distraction and denial. We're still here because We want to explore what it means to awaken wonder and care for the world, to bring these spiritual faculties into play in our own lives. So just a few words about this quality, which is known as bodhicitta. So this is a Pali word. It means, or a Sanskrit word means, bodhi is mind, and citta means, bodhi is awakening. Bodhi, Buddha, bodhi. And citta is mind, so the heart mind of awakening. So Ken MacLeod, a Dharma teacher, he talks about it in very clear ways. He says, bodhicitta as awakening mind is the intention to awaken to life in order to help others awaken to life. So that's an intention that we can set every time we take our seat in meditation. May my practice truly be of benefit to all beings. And just by setting that clear intention, we are working at dissolving that very conditioned, habitual view of self as operating in a vacuum or operating at a distance from everything else. So bodhicitta is the intention to awaken to life in order to help others awaken to life. It is not simply a feeling or an emotion or a sentiment. It has a vertical dimension. A vertical dimension that runs at right angles to our social conditioning and embraces a knowing, a seeing into the nature of experience itself. So when we walk in the woods and see the trees in their winter beauty, maybe the first buds on the cottonwood, maybe the hellebore in bloom. When we walk in the woods and we hear the bird song and feel the wind, intuitively we know that we are all connected, that we belong to nature, that we are the stewards of nature. So at the forest rally, this word interdependence and the word interconnectedness kept showing up over and over again. And I was really impressed because it wasn't just the indigenous speakers, it was the scientists and the activists. So that this notion that our choices, our actions, the way we choose to live, it has an impact. And just as we experience the smoke from the wildfires in the interior of the province, just as we experience, the heat dome, whatever we experience in terms of climate change, we know that that's a result of the global climate changing, often because of the actions of the industrial West. If you think about a small country like Bhutan, whose carbon input is probably negative because of their forests, they are experiencing the effect of our consumption. So, he says, here is the the four great vows in the Zen tradition. Beings are numberless. May I free them all. Reactions are endless. May I release them all. Doors to experience are infinite. May I enter them all. Ways of awakening are limitless. May I know them all. So a pretty big aspiration. But we too can make an aspiration. You know, if we are grandparents, may I spend time with my grandchildren in nature and show them how to listen and look and feel and see. If we are teachers, if we work in an organization, may we encourage respect and care of our resources. And if we are often seduced by the pull of distraction, may I join with others and go for long walks. May I join with others and care for some habitat close to me, some watershed, some stream bed. So it might be your homework tonight is to consider what your aspiration is. You know, maybe even just to commit to your daily practice and let that inform and transform your life. So a bit of awe research. And this also speaks, as I was saying earlier, to the need to resource ourselves. And on a daily basis, especially if we're exposed to the news, it can be a constant wearing down of our feelings of hope and feelings of our agency in terms of the scale of change that is needed. So this is from a psychology article. Even in troubled times, awareness of the beauty in our lives can bring us into the present moment, healing our minds and bodies and restoring our hope. So this is a practice to open to the beauty in our lives. And that might be art, it might be music, it might be exploring your own creative journey. New research reveals how beauty can heal us on many levels. Psychologist Christopher Peterson and colleagues found that a high appreciation of beauty helps people recover from anxiety and depression. Dr. Keltner found that people who experience awe in response to nature's beauty have lower levels of inflammation and thus reduce the risk of depression, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and other illnesses. In fact, their research found that the more we experience awe, the lower our inflammation levels. So, one psychologist has asked students, this was at a college in Idaho, asked students in a psychology class to keep weekly beauty logs, writing brief descriptions of the beauty they observed in nature, art, and in the moral actions of others. So that's kind of an amazing assignment, really. So This leads me to a question I want to ask you. So we'll just sit together for a couple of minutes, and then we'll open it up to people on Zoom, people in the room. So just sitting for a moment. What is the presence of beauty, wonder, and awe? What does that look like in your life? How do you nurture a feeling of reverence for this mystery of being human? Just notice if anything comes to mind, perhaps an image or a story, a reflection. Is there anyone in the Zoom room who has anything they'd like to share?
Button, or you can write a note in the chat.
Maybe there's somebody here, and we'll keep an eye open for the Zoom participants. Oh, Kate. Wait till the microphone comes.
This is a bit off the wall, but the thing that I can't stop thinking about is my new puppy, because he is so full of delight in everything, you know, pieces of plastic on the road and a pile of poo, and everything is exciting to him, every bush. And it sort of has made me pay more attention to the world. I mean, being when we walk through the woods, leaping and jumping, and or you curl up afterward on the couch, and he's a labradoodle, so he has these beautiful big eyes, and he just stares in your eyes. It's like a it's a very emotional experience to have him, and it really has made me more aware of my environment with some awe.
Beautiful.
The place that causes me the most wonder and awe is Mount Arrowsmith, which I live quite close to, and memories of going up there. Now that the snow is on it, it's just, I have to use the word, I'm gobsmacked. It's so beautiful. And I guess almost every hike that I go on, if we have something at the end that is really nice, like a waterfall or a view, that is what gives me the sense of awe and wonder. Man has not created this.
Thank you. Okay.
Here's something from the chat. So someone in the chat said that I love beech trees, and I'm drawn to connect with the one in my neighborhood. And we also have a raised hand.
Great. We actually have two raised hands, and let's start with Jules.
Hi. For me, right now, on clear nights, which are not very often, but there's amazing sight of these two big, beautiful planets that are very close together. And one night, the moon, it's quite not quite half moon, was nearby. And so, yeah, I'm always looking up at the sky when I can on a clear night, but this particular night and the past few nights been really just super amazing. Just every time I look up at the sky, I think, I just ask a whole bunch of questions about life and everything.
Thank you, Jules.
Let's continue with Lydia.
I just stay feeling because I work with children, so they every day remind me to see things differently. So I'm very blessed because my work is with children every day, so I'm blessed. I'm blessed because I have this feeling with them, through them, to see things differently and to pay attention to the little things.
Wonderful.
Hi. I had a few different thoughts, nature, like other people have said. But the other one that came to mind that hasn't been said yet is the first time you really fall deeply and truly in romantic love. And that sense of awe and wonder of that feeling of connection and just everything becomes so magical when you're with that person during that time, the smallest thing and the smallest touch and all of that. I know for me it was a great sense of awe and wonder. Yeah.
So. Great example.
For me, it was going back to my childhood and going out to the farm in Alder Grove and doing what we should do, and that's going to the hay field that was being ready to be cut. It was ripe hay, and my cousin and I, we'd lay down in the hay and crush it, but we could lay there and look up at the blue sky. And then recently I said, "Do you remember doing that?" And she said, "Oh, I loved it. I did it a lot."
Wow.
That's one of my memories that I love.
Beautiful.
I spend a tremendous amount of time outside. And,
I was saying I spend a lot of time outside. And if I have to go somewhere that's... say a 15-minute car drive, I'll probably walk for 45 minutes and just enjoy everything along the way. I look at the moss on the trees and the little snowdrops and the cat that's in the window, and I just have a tremendous amount of delight in almost any street I walk down, so that's my, I guess, sense of awe, is the enjoyment I get from my surroundings.
Beautiful. Which one? Okay, Zoom.
Go ahead and unmute, Susanna. Oh, Susanna, we don't hear you well.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you. For me, it's often connecting with wildlife that provides me with a sense of awe. And just recently, speaking of falling in love for the first time, I spent some time with a two-toed sloth and fell completely in love. And all I could think was something that I heard from someone a few years ago about the pace of health being slow. And I just watched this slow creature in this fast world and was just blown away by how it continues to persist and all of the little microenvironments and creatures that live in its fur, algaes and other little critters that just depend on this creature for survival. And yeah, so that just blew my mind.
Mm. Wow, we're getting such beautiful examples from the actual, like the puppy or the two-eyed sloth, two-toed sloth.
Yes, she says.
Yes, to falling in love, to simply going for a walk and being open to what appears on your path. Or to the beech tree in the neighborhood. I can imagine that tracking the changes in one tree in your neighborhood, I mean, what a wonderful way to feel connected.
I've worked as a volunteer with young people with addictions, and just to see the energy of the of some young people wanting to help the others, and then the awakening of the eyes and the light coming out of their eyes when they're starting to feel better and to manage to deal with their addictions, but just the goodness of wanting to help each other, of being together, it's like just beautiful, like, yeah. And then for me, the heritage growth forests like Francis King, when I go in there and the big trees, it's like, it's as if you were in a chapel. It's like amazingly beautiful. My whole body just goes like, I just don't want to leave there. So anyways, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, and we have one in the back. Thank you for running around with that.
Hi. What I wanted to say that just it's awe, but every morning when I wake up, I always leave my bedroom window a little bit open, and there's a little 2-year-old boy who's on his way to start his day, and he's running, and he's laughing, and he's just got total joy, just being awake and on his feet brings him enormous joy, and I find that we forget that sometimes. Thank you.
Mm. Yes, children, what a source for us, puppies and children.
So, for me, yes, nature, and I was thinking like ideas, like people on the radio who are making and doing amazing things with their lives. I get really sometimes awed. And most recently, though, I did go to the forest rally, and I was awed when I arrived there on the Lachlan because of all the people taking a stand. And there were some huge banners that were beautifully painted. And there was a lot of people and of all ages. And people standing up for what they believe in. And it was so, yeah, I was deeply moved.
Mm. That is a beautiful example of what this neuroscientist calls collective effervescence. But this idea that we can experience that when we see and we're part of a group like that. So it's true, that was very moving.
Oh, is it working? Yes. I just want to say I've got a big garden, and I'm so delighted to weed the garden, plant the seeds, and see it growing. It's about an hour from my house, and it's a heck of a lot of work. It's like every time I weed this thing, It's about 5 hours, you know, and it's a killer. But I love it, you know, watching these plants grow and then harvesting and cooking them. I just love to cook, actually, and you know, it's stuff that's, it's not GMO, you know, it's good stuff, it's organic, and it's, I just love having my own garden. And anyway, it's sort of amazing that this stuff, these tiny little things, and you stick them in the ground and they grow and they're lovely to eat. Very, very satisfying.
That's beautiful. And then you can collect the seed and grow them again.
Yes, I could, and I do.
That reminds me, once I was coming home by bike, and I overheard two little girls chatting, and one of them said to the other, "Guess what? The seeds are up. The lettuce is up." So, well, let's take a walking period. I really appreciate you sharing your reflections. And I know that when we do hear other voices, it's like we recognize, oh, there are so many ways to experience wonder and awe and connect with memories and present moment experience. And in fact, one of the reasons I like walking along Dallas Road is to watch people and their dogs. I just find it so fascinating and hilarious, the personalities, owners and dogs. All right, well, let's do a walking meditation until 3:30, and then we'll finish with a final sit for the day and some closing instructions. So, again, take your time and enjoy this space.